Reeves versus Dinger. Is the appellant ready to argue?
Yes, sir.
Is the government ready to argue?
Yes, sir.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge and members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Captain Bree Ormantel, and I represent the appellant.
Could you speak up a little, please?
I represent the appellant, retired Gunnery Sergeant Derek Dinger. With the court's permission, I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. This case involves the plain language of the statute, which states that transfer to the retirement is conclusive for all purposes. Appellant's punitive discharge while on the retired list violates this statute. The statutory language is plain. The sole function of the court, absent an absurd result, is to enforce it according to its terms.
Could you please speak up? I can't hear you. You need to get closer to the microphone.
Okay. When the statutory language is plain, the sole function of the court, absent an absurd result, is to enforce it according to its terms.
Yeah, okay. Having paid our respects to the late Judge Justice Scalia, is there any extant legislative history of this old statute?
Well, 6332 had its origins in the Naval Appropriations Act of 1916, which stated that members of the Fleet Reserve shall not be discharged from the Naval Reserve Force without their consent, except by sentence of court-martial. In 1938, Congress replaced this language with language similar to the present statute. Notably, in its new version, Congress removed the clause except by sentence of court-martial. The 1938 statute was reenacted in 1952. Now, removal of this clause except by sentence of court-martial, it reinforces congressional intent that conclusive for all purposes means what it says. A retiree on a retired list with an honorable discharge cannot be awarded a punitive discharge.
Well, does it mean that counsel, I'm not sure this is free from ambiguity. The transfer is conclusive for all purposes. In other words, you're transferred. You're in there now. Does that necessarily act to oust court-martial jurisdiction?
Your Honor, the appellant would argue that it does, because once, if it does not, then that means that the appellant's retirement pay is subject to alienation, which is
subject to what?
To removal, to alienation.
Okay.
So the appellant would argue that it is not. In fact, in the court in Allen, implied 6332, define the transfer of a term service member to a retirement list as conclusive for all purposes. This was a well-founded decision. It was based on a 1940 Comptroller General opinion. The court didn't cite Article 18, which would have done if the lower court's analysis were correct.
Now, counsel, you cited the fact that Congress rescinded 6332. But that language that you're referring to was not rescinded in isolation, which would be a good argument on your part. In fact, didn't Congress rescind a very large portion of the statute that included 6332? And if that's the case, then doesn't that in some way reduce the power of the argument?
Well, Your Honor, that is, you're correct, Your Honor. However, had Congress wanted to exclude court-martial from its, in that 1938 enactment, Congress clearly removed this clause, except by sentence of court-martial. Had they wanted to exclude court-martial, or they wanted to make any clear, a clarity, notably in Section 10 U.S.C. 6329, the code does refer to court-martial. It states, no officer of the Navy or the Marine Corps may be retired because of misconduct for which trial by court-martial would be appropriate. That suggests that had Congress wanted to exclude court-martial, it could have done so. But indeed, they made the determination, which is clear through the text itself, that there is no exception that transfer to the retired list is conclusive for all purposes. The only exception that the statute notes is for error or omission. thereby excluding other exceptions. In fact, Congress has, in other circumstances, notably the HISS Act, has made a clear policy against alienation of retirement benefits, making it clear that that is to be an exception, that 6332, when it says the transfer to the retired list is conclusive for all purposes, means what it says.
So if appellant were in the Air Force, would this apply?
No, it would not.
So why would Congress treat Air Force personnel, Army personnel, worse than appellant?
Your Honor, this court has not briefed the issue of equal protection. However, their services all have different customs and customs. This court may be uncomfortable with the congressional language, with the congressional statement that for the Navy, that 6332 makes transfer to retirement list conclusive for all purposes. But even though it may be just uncomfortable with that language, the fact is the language is very clear, and Congress made a clear pronouncement that transfer should be conclusive.
Leaving aside equal protection, it's the uniform code of military justice. The fundamental, one of the fundamental objects of Congress in enacting it was to do away with the Articles of War, the Articles for the Government of the Navy, two separate codes that had existed since 1800, and unify them. Now, why would Congress have left the glaring anomaly of a punishment authorized by law and authorized in the manual for everybody but enlisted personnel of the Marines and the Navy?
Well, Your Honor, without speculating, the government, this court itself in Allen has accepted that 6332, finding a transfer service member to the retired list, finding a transfer Navy service member, was conclusive for all purposes. That court didn't cite to Article 18, which was cited by the lower court here. It didn't cite Article 18 because it can't. Article 18 cannot override the plain language of statute. For Article 18, notably, is a broad grant of authority. It actually refers to jurisdiction, which is not an issue here, which addresses punishment in the broadest terms without identifying what those punishments are. It provides...
No, counsel, I didn't ask that question. I asked, why would the notion of uniformity foremost in its mind, very well to have a disquisition on Article 18, but it's supposed to be uniform. Why is a punishment available to all officers and all enlisted except Navy and Marine? Not a totally glaring anomaly which Congress couldn't have intended in the face of the drive for uniformity.
And yet, this statute, again, has a long history going back to 1916.
Well, that's pre-uniform.
Right.
And 1938 is pre-uniform.
But 1952
was... We can excuse that.
Yes, Your Honor. 1952 was not pre-uniformity. In 1952, the statute was reenacted.
As again, part of the Reserve Act.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, it's hard to speculate why Congress may have done what it did, but the point is their statute is very clear. And while there is some uncomfortableness with that, this court's sole function when faced with clear language which says that transfer to retired list is conclusive for all purposes.
Now, why isn't conclusive for all purposes a reference to creditable years of service, grade, year placed on retirement list? Why does it incorporate the discharge?
Because a punitive discharge would necessarily affect those pay and allowances. So you can't have one. It would make no sense to authorize a punitive discharge, but at the same time say a statute, a clear statute, that you can't affect pay and retirement allowances. Pay and allowances.
Counsel, may I shift gears a little bit? The government argues in its brief that this issue was waived for three reasons. The government argues that in the pretrial agreement, the appellant agreed that a punitive discharge was authorized, that the issue was not preserved in the pretrial agreement, and also that it was an unconditional guilty plea. Could you address those arguments?
Yes, Your Honor. Based on the Supreme Court's holding in Plass, the appellant has not waived his right to appeal. As the Supreme Court recognized in Plass, a plea agreement does not necessarily bar the defendant from appealing, nor is a conditional plea required to preserve that right. As with Plass, the appellant's claim does not challenge the charges by denying the underlying conduct. He challenges the lawfulness of the punishment imposed, contrary to 6332's conclusiveness for all purposes treatment. And notably, the judge in class actually, in the lower court district court case, the judge in class did actually engage in a colloquy with the defendant to ask if he understood that he was giving up his right to appeal. But the Supreme Court did not find that to be a barrier to an appellate right to appeal. Like class, who never waived his right to appeal the constitutionality of the statute he was convicted of, appellant and his PTA never agreed not to challenge the lawfulness of his punishment. In fact, he only agreed not to raise motions based on illegal pretrial confinement and unlawful search and seizure. So the government would submit, the appellant would submit that there has been no waiver, that class clearly applies, and appellant should be allowed to appeal, which his appeal does not challenge his conviction. He is not denying the conduct that he was accused of. He's challenging the lawfulness of the statute, which is is the same as Platt.
Captain, can I go back to the prior part of your argument, dealing with Judge Stuckey's concern that this is inconsistent with the uniformity requirement, or thought of uniformity when the code was enacted. And there's a case called United States versus U.S. versus Hooper. And U.S. versus Hooper is a Navy case.
Yes, sir.
And in that case, there was a rear admiral who received the dismissal and total forfeitures. And he was on, I think at the time, the retired list. And so, what do you make of that? I mean, your argument, you could take the position that, well, hey, they were, the court was wrong back then. And just because they decided back then doesn't mean they should stay with that precedent. But what's your position on Hooper? And the only reason I point Hooper out is because it's a Navy case.
Yes, Your Honor. Hooper, as well as I believe Overton, those are cases of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. This is a case of lawfulness of punishment. The lower court in Dinger accepted a rule that the court had jurisdiction to tie to Dinger, but this 6332 goes to the lawfulness of the punishment.
I understand, but you would think that someone would have taken issue with that before now on the issue of the punitive discharge in those cases, given the fact that, I can't remember with Overton, but I think given the fact that Hooper was actually on the retired list, that would kind of fall squarely into the situation that we have here today. You see what my concern is?
Yes,
I don't mind you saying that we were wrong. You know, I mean, maybe we weren't, but I want to know what your position is, other than the fact that it's their issue.
Well,
which is true.
Yes, Your Honor. This court in Sloan, which while it did not examine 6332, it examined an Army regulation in similar language, said that Hooper is of limited utility because it deals only with jurisdiction.
So, because it deals what?
Only it deals with jurisdiction. So, again, the court has never been briefed. The issue has always come up as jurisdiction. I can't speculate. The appellant cannot speculate on this, but the point is there is very clear language. Two decisions by this court, Allen and Sloan, which had interpreted 6332.
But in Allen, I think language is somewhat restrictive, or at least less than inclusive, of a, if you want to talk about the punishments. I thought in Allen, the reference was to reduction in grade, that kind of punishment, and it really made no reference to a punitive discharge, did it?
That's correct, because they were only looking at the discharge under Article 58 of the UCMJ. But the language still applies, and again, it was going back to a 1940 Controller General decision, so it wasn't that it was a well, it wasn't well thought out. 6332 is very, very specific, which is why it should override Article 18, which is a broad grant of authority which gives the president the ability by executive order to limit punishments. 6332 is in fact prohibited retirement.
Well, why isn't 6332 a jurisdictional statute depriving, purportedly, depriving a court-martial of jurisdiction over certain punishments?
Well, Your Honor, I almost admit that it's not jurisdictional. It is...
well, if it's not jurisdictional, it would seem to, as the government argues, be waivable. So, aren't you on one or two prongs of a dilemma?
Well, the Congress in Article 2A specifically says that there is jurisdiction in this case. Congress knew Article 6332, would then conflict. It's not jurisdictional, or it conflicts, it would flat out conflict with Article 2A. Article 63 just limits the punishments that may be awarded, and it only limits the punishments to Navy personnel. Again, this court has accepted that on many, several occasions. The rule of statutory construction, says that 6332 must prevail over any general language under Article 18 of the code. This court should apply the longstanding precedent and disprove appellant's discharge. I see that I have time.
Chief Judge, I have one, yep. Just one last question, unless anyone else does.
Go ahead, John.
Captain, don't we have a precedent in our system that punitive discharges, at least that part of the sentence, that kind of punishment, is different from the other kinds of punishments contained in the court martial sentence? I'm asking, I should ask my law clerk this, but I'm asking you. Sorry. But I mean, I think I remember some cases that talk about that. Am I wrong? And if I am, so.
Your Honor, to be honest, I don't have an answer. All I would say is that 6332, if it says pay is final and you give someone a punitive discharge, it doesn't make sense. So it has to be read more inclusively.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Suzuki, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Brian Farrell, and I, along with Colonel Valerie Danilov, represent the United States. This court should affirm appellant's punitive discharge for two reasons. First, he waived this issue. And second, Section 6332 does not and cannot limit available punishments at a court's martial because it is outside of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Starting with our waiver argument, the United States essentially has two waiver arguments. First, that appellant intentionally relinquished a known right under United States v. Gladden. And second, that appellant's unconditional guilty plea waived this issue pursuant to United States v. Bradley. Starting with the Gladden waiver, Sir Judge Maggs, as you pointed out, our argument is that appellant waived this issue pursuant to the terms of the pretrial agreement, which he bargained for prior to the military judge ruling that a punitive discharge was authorized. The pretrial agreement was signed by appellant on 4 December. The military judge's ruling was on the day of the sentencing hearing, which was 17 December. And the bench briefs filed by both parties were after signing of the pretrial agreement. So our position is that appellant waived this issue, and this court should extend its ruling in Gladue based on the language of the pretrial agreement, which not only stated that the convening authority could approve a punitive discharge as a judge, but also had notification provisions in Part 1 informing appellant of exactly what a punitive discharge could do to his retirement pay and benefits.
So why was there any valid pretrial agreement? There was no meeting of the minds. In the terms of the pretrial agreement, it said X. Then in the course of the back and forth during the guilty plea, the accused is saying Y. The government is not fighting back on that point. The military judge is saying, we have a busted plea. Instead, trial counsel doesn't do anything. The military judge lets it go through. Using fundamental principles of contract law, why wouldn't we say the plea agreement is busted? There's no such thing as that.
Well, I don't think the plea agreement was busted, Your Honor, just based on the fact that appellant continued to plead guilty pursuant to the same pretrial agreement both before and after the military judge's ruling. So our position is that he received the very bargain.
So let's play this out in the real world consequences. If this court were to say a situation such as this, where pretrial agreement says X, then the course of the actual plea, the appellant, the accused, is saying, despite what I just signed, in fact, I disavow what I signed. Trial counsel lets it go through, military judge lets it go through. Why wouldn't we be seeing this all the time? We have to be concerned about efficiency within the military justice system. If we've got that type of scenario, why wouldn't trial defense counsel always want to live to fight another day at the appellate level? So why should we say that this pretrial agreement was even in effect?
I guess my only answer to Your Honor's question is that the posture of the litigation was rather unique in this case because it wasn't a motion brought by appellant. They were bench memos requested by the military judge. So, I would just rely on the fact that the military judge requested bench memos, both parties provided them, and then the military judge very quickly in an 802, and then at the pre-sentencing hearing on the day of the pleas, provided his ruling on whether the punishment was authorized or not. And more importantly, the appellant continued to keep the same agreement, regardless of the military judge's ruling. So we find it important that the appellant sign the agreement prior to the ruling. And even if this court doesn't want to extend the Gladue waiver based on that language within the agreement, there's still the Bradley waiver for his unconditional guilty plea, which the military judge had a very specific colloquy with the appellant, ensuring that he understood his ruling regarding the punitive discharge, and that appellant, both upon advice of counsel and after discussion with counsel, still wanted to plead guilty.
Captain Farrell, could you address the class case that appellant cited just now in your argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The United States doesn't believe class changed the guilty plea waiver jurisprudence really at all, because class was about the constitutionality of the statute, which we would probably agree is at least jurisdictional as far as subject matter jurisdiction. If a statute is unconstitutional on its face, which was the issue in class, or at least the issue that was the Supreme Court said could be decided and was not waived, then there is no jurisdiction over the appellant if there's no criminal statute that he violated. Here we're talking about something completely different. As appellant agreed with Judge Sparks, that 6332 is not jurisdictional. But that should be dispositive to the unconditional guilty plea waiver. If 6332 is not jurisdictional, then appellant waived this issue, since it's a non-jurisdictional alleged defect. And that's exactly, the posture of this case is almost identical to Bradley.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the appellant, which is, may the accused plead to an unlawful punishment? Isn't that slop, or at least leak into jurisdiction? to impose the punishment. I mean, obviously, he, as a member of the Fleet Reserve, is subject to Article 2. I'm not talking about jurisdiction over the person. Yeah, I'm talking about something else.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I would, my answer to you would be 99% of the time, yes. This is the 1%. And we would refer you to United States v. Beatty, a more recent case in United States v. Bush, where this court was discussing the lawfulness of a maximum authorized sentence. But there, the issue was RCM 1003. And while RCM 1003 is promulgated by the President pursuant to Article 18, which is a jurisdictional statute, that makes RCM 1003 quasi-jurisdictional, the interpretation or analysis of RCM 1003. We're not talking about RCM 1003. We're talking about 10 U.S.C. 6332, which is not in the code and was not passed by Congress pursuant to any jurisdictional context. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, no. I was. Does the fortuity that this statute, 6332, was not codified in Chapter 47 of Title 10 mean anything?
That absolutely, Your Honor. That's exactly what the United States' argument is, and I'll move on to the merits section of our argument based on that question. This court's analysis, the United States believes, should end with Article 18. Because this court should not start its analysis with a statutory interpretation of 10 U.S.C. 6332. It should start with Article 18, which is within the code. And Article 18 says any punishment is authorized that's not prohibited by something in the code or by the president, which would be RCM 1003. And Congress did, in fact, prohibit several types of punishments. In Article 55, for cruel and unusual type punishments. And then it enacted Article 56.
Branding, flogging, marking.
And irons. Yes, sir. But that just shows that Congress knew how to do it.
But, counsel, isn't that argument inconsistent with Allen and Sloan? I mean, if that had been the argument in Allen and Sloan, those cases would have come out the opposite way.
I agree, Your Honor. We're asking this court to overrule Allen and Sloan if it feels that Allen and Sloan are dispositive to this case, which we don't think it necessarily is, since Allen and Sloan were reduction cases, and this is a punitive discharge case, which, as you stated earlier, Judge Olson, 6332's language, if you read it directly, it really applies to credible years of service and grade and rank, which would tend to, which seems to support Allen and Sloan. But we believe Allen and Sloan were wrongly decided. Specifically, Allen and Sloan was more of a continuation of the Allen logic. But if you want me to go to why this court should overturn Allen, I can. And obviously, this would be a quick test. And the United States believes that the most important reason to overturn Allen is because it's badly reasoned. It ignores the plain language of Article 18. And it essentially applies a military due process type right. When you look at the analysis of Allen, it doesn't even necessarily or completely rely on 6332. It relies on the custom of the naval service, and it even specifically discusses how the Army and Air Force have a different custom. But then Sloan extended that to the Army. Allen also discusses a law review article from a Professor Bishop. And then it also cites 6332. It does not apply the code. This court, in United States v. Vasquez, specifically stated that an appellant's rights comes from specific places, the Constitution, the code, and the manual. And here the code is clear, and that's Article 18.
What about appellant's argument that Article 18 really is subordinated to 6332?
Well, I think that argument fails for two reasons. It conflicts with Bartlett, which we cited in our brief. And Bartlett was a case about the tension between Article 25 and a statute enacted by Congress authorizing the Secretary of the Army to enact regulations. We think that is pretty similar to this case because here we're talking about secretarial action. That's what 6332 is about. When you look at the comptroller decision that appellant cites and relies upon, and that Allen also relied upon incorrectly, That comptroller decision was about a secretary's, the Secretary of the Navy's action. The Secretary of the Navy wanted to take some individuals off the retirement list because of a difference in the law regarding computation of service. That's exactly what 6332 is about. But Article 18...
Dropping from the rolls?
Are you talking about the comptroller decision, Your Honor?
Well, you're saying the secretary wanted to get rid of this guy.
No,
administratively. Are we talking about dropping from the rolls or what?
No, I believe the comptroller decision was about bringing them back on active duty.
Okay.
The secretary did not want them to be retired because of a difference in the... That's how I read the comptroller decision. But more importantly is that Article 18 is specific to courts-martial. And it's not only specific to courts-martial, it's specific to sentences at a courts-martial. 6332 doesn't discuss courts-martial. It doesn't discuss sentences at a courts-martial. So to say that 6332 is somehow more specific than Article 18, we believe is just wrong because, as we stated at the outset, this court's analysis, the issue here is whether a punitive discharge is an authorized punishment to be a judge at a court-martial. Now, the collateral consequences of what may or may not happen based on that punitive discharge really should be determined by another court. And I would go back to your question to appellant, Your Honor, about Hooper v. United States. The United States doesn't necessarily believe that this court's opinion in Hooper is as important as the Court of Claims' opinion was in Hooper. Because the Court of Claims, I believe 5 years later in 1964, the Admiral in Hooper brought a claim before that court saying, my dismissal should not lead to an elimination of my retirement benefits. And the Court of Claims rejected that argument.
Well, but of course, we're talking about apples and oranges here. This statute only applies to enlisted people. This statute only applies to people transferred to the Fleet Reserve and Fleet Marine Reserve. That's enlisted people. Hooper was an admiral. Hooper doesn't come within this statute anyway. So where's that leave us? I
absolutely agree, Ron. My point was a little bit broader, and it goes back to appellant makes a leap that this court shouldn't do, which is that a punitive discharge would eliminate retirement benefits and therefore somehow violate 6332. That hasn't happened yet. And that wouldn't necessarily happen upon the execution of this discharge. What this court should be deciding is whether it can be adjudged at a court-martial, and then the executive actions that happen later are collateral consequences, similar to, and we cited United States v. Summerall, where it was discussed, and more importantly, in the Supreme Court case in Clinton v. Goldsmith, where the Supreme Court said that a removal from the rolls is a collateral consequence that's outside of this court's jurisdiction in that Exrick case. That's really where Collins' argument is, and that decision should be by the Court of Claims or the District Court under either the Tucker Act, Little Tucker Act, or something along those lines. But here, the issue is whether a punitive discharge should be adjudged, and that's why the United States points to Article 18 and its plain language, which does not lead to absurd results because it's uniform.
Another question. Everyone has sort of tossed this around. This is a Navy unique statute, blah, 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 blah. There actually is a statute of general application, now codified at 10 U.S.C. 12738. It's old 10 U.S.C. 1338, and it provides for reserve officers transferred to the retired reserve, basically the same sort of thing, that you're transferred, that once you get your, quote, 20-year letter, you've done the required duty, you're entitled to be transferred to the retired reserve when you leave. It's festooned, however, with saving clauses. That it clearly is not applicable to trials by courts-martial because it says so. Now, why would Congress pass a statute of general application like this, which goes back to the Reserve Act of 52 when this other thing was reenacted, and then keep this artifact in the Navy section?
I I probably don't know why Congress would do that.
Would Congress do anything?
I agree that the retirement section is
but,
a quagmire.
But I think the government's position isn't it? It doesn't matter.
Correct.
It's not in Title 10. It's not in the code. Neither of these is. They're all in the person. One's in ROTMA, and the other's in the Navy section, but neither of them's in Chapter 47.
That's where we are. 6332 is in Title 10, but it's not in Chapter 47, which we think is dispositive. And I would go back to, I'm not familiar with the statute you just read.
No reason you should be.
But I would say that, going back to one of your questions for Cohen, even 6332 is not free from ambiguity, as you said, which should, you know, if you were even going to get to an interpretation of 6332.
Are you aware of any pertinent legislative history of 6332?
I did review some of the legislative history, Your Honor, and I would say that it's muddy and unclear on exactly what, but I would say
What we got from the appellant was a recounting of statutory language. I'm more interested in report language, if there was any.
I believe there was, Your Honor, and I did review it. I would not say that it was enlightening either way. I didn't find it too enlightening. I don't have any specific quotes for you because I did not find them to be important. But to go to appellant's statement about the change in the language, if you didn't want to get there, appellant really hinges on the fact that Congress eliminated the except for a court-martial from 6332. Well, that wasn't the only part of that very sentence that Congress eliminated. They also eliminated the jurisdictional hook, which was that a retiree in that section is subject to the laws and regulations. That's entirely consistent with the United States' argument that upon enactment of the code, they didn't need a jurisdictional hook, and they didn't need the except from a sentence from a court-martial, because that's handled by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That was the intent of Congress in 1950 to pass that, and then that's the plain language of Article 18. And unless there are any further questions, that concludes the United States' argument. This court should affirm appellant's punitive discharge.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have a rebuttal?
Your Honor, I would just like to return to the argument under class as to whether or not there's a waiver. Unlike Ledoux, which the government cites, the appellant here did not waive all waivable motions. This is much more similar to class, where the government the Supreme Court on page 10 of the slip opinion in class says, the government concedes that the written agreement which sets forth the complete agreement between class and the government does not contain this waiver. Rather, the government relies on the fact that during the Rule 11 plea colloquy, the district court judge stated that under a written plea agreement, class was giving up his right to appeal his conviction. Again, class clearly did not give up the right. He did not state that in his plea agreement. Similar in this case, the appellant only gave up the right to challenge illegal pretrial confinement and an illegal search and seizure. And like class, the judge also went into a colloquy where he discussed, do you understand the consequences? So a guilty plea by itself does not take away the ability to appeal, particularly when the guilty plea does not challenge the underlying conduct, where it doesn't change the appellant is not arguing that he did not commit misconduct. He is challenging the statute itself. In addition, appellant would also like to address 6332, where the government cites Bartlett. Appellant would argue that this Bartlett is not controlling. Bartlett was actually reviewing a general statute, looking at the code in connection with a general statute which allowed the Secretary of the Army to make rules. This is a clear case of the code conflicting with a very specific statute. It is not addressing a further regulation by the Army or by the Navy, rather, in this case.
there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Clerk will recess the court.
Court stands in recess until further order of the court. Please remain seated as we proceed to the question and answer segment.
Thank you. Court is now.